So, on behalf of the court, we wish you all a happy new year. We're happy to see you. Today, the case that we're going to hear in this time slot is RAM 23AP 441. We have a full house because East Troy High School is here. If you could stand. Nice to have you here. Welcome. I'm glad you didn't have a icy, horrible ride in today, so it's good to see you here. Go ahead and have a seat. Platteville High School, if you could stand. Thank you. Nice to see you as well. And Waupun High School. Excellent. You all here. With that, we will proceed this morning. Could I please have counsel's appearances in the case?
Attorney Courtney Rowland appears as guardian ad litem petitioner.
Attorney Ken Harris appears for David
Chapman. All right. Nice to see you all this morning. And please proceed. 15 minutes, followed by 12 minutes. 30 minutes, and then 3 minutes on rebuttal, correct?
Yes.
Good. All right.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Courtney Rowlands, and I am the guardian ad litem petitioner in this case, representing the child's best interests. This case is about distinguishing waiver of counsel from default judgment to maintain circuit court discretion to manage uncooperative behavior from litigants in TPR cases. I have two main points. First, we are asking this court to clarify the difference between Wisconsin Statute Section 48.23, sub 2, sub b, sub 3, and default judgment, specifically holding that an egregiousness finding is not unique to 48.23, and therefore an egregiousness finding does not automatically waive a parent's right to counsel.
Counsel, in your brief, on page 1, your reply brief, you take the position, of course, and in your argument, that RAM's argument is flawed because the two-day waiting period, in order to it apply, the court must have found waiver of counsel. That's your argument. Where in the statute do you find I'm concerned because, in part, it seems untethered to the words of the statute, that argument that you advance. So point me to the words of the statute that support your argument as articulated on page 1 of your reply brief.
Your Honor, I cannot point you to specific words, but I can point you to a rationale. The words egregious conduct are not unique to 48.23 sub 2 sub b sub 3. It's used there, but it's also used in default judgment, specifically at Wisconsin Statutes 80210 sub 7, 80.14.12, 80.503, and as articulated by this court in Dane County DHS versus Mabel K. Default judgment applies when a non-complying party acts egregiously or in bad faith. And so if an egregious conduct finding is on its own sufficient to trigger 48.23 sub 2 sub b sub 3, every single time a parent acts in bad faith even or egregiously and is defaulted without any notice, really, a parent is going to lose their right to counsel.
Okay, where is that connection, though? I was right there with you until the last couple words you said. Why would losing your right to counsel? That's not what the statute says. It says it's a presumption of waiver of counsel. It doesn't mean they lose their right to counsel.
Your Honor, I agree. The statute doesn't say that, but the Court of Appeals opinion does.
All right. So you want us to clarify the Court of Appeals opinion in that way?
Yes. I want this court to clarify that the Court of Appeals opinion should be overruled or reversed to indicate that a egregious finding alone is not sufficient to trigger that two-day waiting period because that presumption is not automatic.
Okay, what you just said is something totally different. The egregious period is enough to trigger the 2 days, but it doesn't necessarily mean that counsel has been waived because you just said egregiousness can be a basis for default, right? And then you look at the statute, and the statute, the last line of 48.23b3 says if the court made this egregious finding, then you have to wait 2 days. So egregiousness equals default equals presumption of waiver of counsel, not necessarily waiver, but equals 2-day waiting period.
Your Honor, I think that only applies if the Court of Appeals opinion is correct that this is a legal presumption and not the common ordinary meaning of presume. So that's where my first brief comes in, that if the Court of Appeals opinion is correct, that uttering the words egregiousness is enough to trigger that 2-day waiting period, it means that presume is being used to say that an egregiousness finding creates a rebuttable presumption of a waiver of the right to counsel, which then makes us operate in this statute. Otherwise, the trial court in this case was operating under 80503. And so the reality of the Court of Appeals opinion is that RAM, by the Court of Appeals reasoning, lost her right to an attorney without the court intending to waive or discharge or do anything in 48.23.
Well, counsel, you have to admit, her attorney, while allowed to stay on her case, really had her hands tied behind her back, right?
Your Honor, the attorney was not permitted to call witnesses, but that was allowable under Wisconsin statute section 804.12 sub 2 sub a sub 2. That statute applies under 80503 for failure to obey a court order. It's an allowable sanction that allows the exclusion of evidence and the exclusion of witnesses. Here, too, if you look at record document 66, that is RAM's witness list. That witness list was exhausted except for three people. One was a case manager who had been on the case for 2 months. One was RAM herself, who was midstream in her cross-examination on the date before she failed to appear. And the last was her therapist. If you look at document 107, page 15, RAM's counsel indicated, quote, "I'm not calling that witness." That witness was in the hallway and was sent home because
But the record's pretty clear. She wasn't allowed full capacity to perform her duties or her role as RAM's attorney. But let me just ask you this. In your brief, you talk about the sanctions that should be allowed upon a default judgment in a TPR. Is that an issue here?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that question?
The sanctions that should be allowed?
I believe that is the crux of the issue here, and that does bring me to my second point, which is that default judgment sanctions are separate procedures from the waiver of the right to counsel, and that the circuit court is empowered to enter those sanctions and enter default judgment in a TPR case. Default judgment is available in TPR pursuant to Wisconsin Statute .293 sub 4, which indicates that Chapter 804 shall apply to all proceedings in this chapter. And the court also indicated, this court indicated in Evelyn C.R. versus Tequila S., 2001, Wisconsin 100, that default judgment is available in TPR. Any sanction that is entered, though, must be just, and the non-complying party must act egregiously or in bad faith. So that is from Dane County DHS versus Mabel K. We also know from State versus Shirley E. that the right to counsel is preserved through a default judgment. So default judgment does not automatically waive the right to counsel. It does not automatically trigger the statute of the waiver of the right to counsel. So that leaves sanctions and what sanctions might be allowed. There is developed law on how default works at grounds, but there is not developed case law on how default works at disposition. Wisconsin statute section 48.427 indicates that any party may present relevant evidence, and the state is going to argue that that means that default judgment cannot apply at TPR disposition. That is where the state and I diverge. There's nothing in that statute that indicates that what a circuit court is to do when a necessary party is uncooperative at TPR disposition or not showing up at TPR disposition or lying about their whereabouts, as in this case, and not coming to disposition. So a circuit court needs to have discretion to manage their courtroom and to manage a case. So to say that default judgment cannot apply, that sanctions for failure to obey court orders cannot apply, that discovery sanctions could not apply simply because a statute says relevant evidence can be admitted is absurd.
Okay, do we need to get to this issue that you're raising here? I mean, I understand you're saying to us that it's not developed, but the point is that she, what I understand that REM is asking for is 2 days. Not like what happens at the disposition, but 2 days instead of proceeding directly from disposition to, from grounds to disposition. That's what I read this as.
Your Honor, I think you must get to this issue because 48.23 either does not apply here or is unconstitutional, which brings me back to my first point.
Okay. Why is it unconstitutional?
Because, okay, might I try to lay some groundwork before I answer your question? Thank you. A court might enter an egregious conduct finding and hold that a parent has waived the right to counsel. That might be a thing that happens under 48.23. But a court may enter an egregious conduct finding and hold a parent in default for failure to follow a court order, not invoke 48.23(2)(b)(3), and then they need to allow counsel to participate under the mandate of Shirley E. That is what happened in this case. The trial court did not make a finding of the waiver of the right to counsel. The trial court specified 5 times that the egregiousness finding was a default finding. She used the word default 5 times in the record, which puts this case under 80503. We're not in 48.23 at all.
So how would you get to 48.23? What would she have had to do besides saying the word, I'm finding that you were egregiously violating my court order? How would you get to 48.23?
There needs to be more findings because right in this case, she said, I'm finding this conduct egregious and I'm finding RAM in default. For 48.23, it would have been, I'm finding this conduct egregious and I'm waiving her right to counsel.
Why?
Because it applies in two situations. 48.23 never uses the word default. And so realistically, we shouldn't have used the word egregious. We can't correct what the legislature did or go back in time to make them use a different word there, but that word was already a term of art as to default judgment. And so the fact that she used the word egregious but also said, I'm finding you in default, that's 80503. But the Court of Appeals held that we're in 48.23, and it held that an egregiousness finding being entered obligates that 2 days, not that a finding of waiver or counsel requires 2 days, which ignores the sources of law that turn on egregious conduct, ignores that the trial court made specific findings of default judgment, and it ignores this court's findings in Shirley E. that a parent's right to counsel survives a default judgment.
So can I just follow up and make sure I understand your argument? So you've got this sort of legal term of art, right? You have the parent acted egregiously and in bad faith by violating some court order, discovery order of some sort. And that particular factual finding was already in existence at law, can be used to sanction the party, including, you know, default, correct?
Correct.
And then the legislature in 2013 comes and takes this legal term of art that also is a factual finding that can be used for default. It plugs it into this new statute that can be used to provide waiver of counsel by conduct. And what you're saying is the only time we're even in 48, that exception, 48.23 2B3, is when that finding is used to support waiver. And if it's used to support default and not used to support waiver, we're not in that world at all. That statute isn't implicated, and therefore you have no waiting period.
Correct. That is my argument. Since this was pre-existing, since this court has acknowledged that default judgment is available and that default does not extinguish the right to an attorney, I don't think this court should find or uphold the Court of Appeals finding that 48.23 is somehow automatically triggered by the use of that word.
Let me ask you a follow-up question. If the court was explicitly sort of in this world and found that there had been egregious and bad faith conduct, and So that triggers this presumption of a waiver. I know you argue it's ordinary meaning. Put that aside for a minute. There is, let's assume it's a legal presumption for the minute, or whatever, all right? But let's say that you have an attorney who represents, say, no, I'm here, I have direction for my client. Yes, my client violated your order, but I'm here to vigorously represent my client's interest. The court says, okay, I am not waiving counsel, you still have counsel, and all this is explicit on the record. And then you go through, and you would say their no waiting period or their waiting period. So a finding that was made, presumption overcome, you still have counsel, there has been no waiver of counsel. Does there need to be a waiting period between the grounds phase and disposition phase in your view or not?
No, because the court could allow that participation under State versus Shirley E., which is what happened here. This court needs to analyze under Shirley E., which is the only law on limiting counsel for a parent who is not appearing. In that case, the court found it was a total deprivation when the attorney was physically removed from the courtroom. This was not a total deprivation. This court should assess whether or not default sanctions are allowable at TPR disposition when you would allow the attorney to continue to represent their client without their appearance because they have been in communication. Like I said, that is what happened here. RAM had been in communication with her lawyer that morning. She said that she was going to clear a warrant. 4 hours later, she said she was still on the way to the police station. 2 hours after that, still said she was on the way to the police station. And the trial court found that she was acting in bad faith and manipulating the court, that she was not truly... I'm sorry, I see I'm out of time.
Go ahead and finish your sentence or two.
The court found that she was manipulating her whereabouts and was not truly going to clear that warrant, but allowed her attorney to participate.
May it please the Court. Chief Justice, Your Honors, my name is Jenny Spies-Karras, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. This case is about ensuring a parent's right to counsel throughout the entirety of a termination of parental rights case and ensuring that children in the foster care system achieve permanency in a timely manner. I have two main points. First, the Court of Appeals incorrectly interpreted Wisconsin Statute 48.23 sub 2 sub b sub 3, the presumed waiver of counsel statute. And second, the Court of Appeals incorrectly decided that the trial court lost competency to proceed to the dispositional hearing. First, the Court of Appeals in State versus RAM incorrectly interpreted the statute to be explicit and automatic. This statute should be discretionary and explicit. As the guardian ad litem explained in her arguments, the Court of Appeals determined that this statute was a automatic waiver of counsel as soon as the Court of Appeals or the trial court said the words egregious and without justifiable excuse. However, there are other situations in which the court says this, like findings egregious and without justifiable, or like the default findings. This implicit waiver of counsel creates absurd results. These
counsel, it may not get to the level of absurd, but it seems at least odd to me that we're talking about waiver of counsel when RAM's counsel participated in the dispositional hearing even after RAM has supposedly waived the right to counsel, according to arguments advanced. So I don't know what you do with this oddity, but... The procedural posture is puzzling. Can you respond to that?
Yes, that's the confusing part of this case. From the state's point of view, There was never a waiver of counsel, and there was never a discharge of counsel. However, the Court of Appeals in this case found that there was a waiver of counsel by the court, the trial court, saying the words egregious and justifiable excuse. And I read the Court of Appeals decision also seemed to find an implicit discharge based on some restriction of the ability to question and call witnesses. However, the counsel was never discharged, and there was never a waiver. So that's the confusing part of the decision of the Court of Appeals, and that is why we are asking that this court overrule the decision of the Court of Appeals and find that there was never a waiver. In order for there to be a waiver, it is the state's position that there needs to be an explicit finding on the record. When the court makes a waiver when going through a waiver with a parent, when they're doing a waiver of counsel through the ordinary method of questioning them, they accept that waiver and make an explicit finding on the record. When going through the presumed waiver of counsel...
Assume that we agree with you on this point and that there was not a waiver of counsel for the reasons that you are talking about and for the reasons that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley just pointed out, which is, come on, she had counsel. There's no question about it, both in the fact-finding and the dispo stage. So just assume that we agree with you on that point. I still am not sure then what we do with the last sentence of 4823-2B3, which says, if the court finds that a parent's conduct in failing to appear as ordered was egregious and without clear and justifiable excuse, and I think everyone agrees that happened, right? You agree that the court made that finding, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then it says the court may not hold the dispo hearing on the contested adoption or involuntary termination of parental rights until the 2 days have elapsed since the date of that finding.
Your Honor,
that's my question. Like, assume we agree with you on waiver. What do we do with that last sentence in the statute?
Your Honor, I think that turns me to my second issue, the issue of competency. I think if you look at Wisconsin Statute 48.315 sub 3, when you look at that statute specifically states, failure by the court or any party to act within any time period specified in this chapter does not deprive the court of any personal or subject matter jurisdiction or of competency to exercise that jurisdiction.
That statute talks about failure. Both the first sentence talks about failure by the court or a party to act. The second is failure to object to a period of delay or continuance. There was no failure of anyone to act in this case. The court, in fact, did act, which is the problem. The problem isn't that the court failed to do something within a statutory time period. The issue here is that the court did do something before the 2 days was over. So I'm not so sure that 48.315, delays, continuances, and extensions, is relevant to the issue here.
Your Honor, I think if you look, it does not specify in that statute. It says within any time period. It does not talk about acting before or after. It says within any time period. It does not talk about exceeding or acting prematurely. So that statute...
Wait. You don't think failure applies to act in the second phrase of sub 3? Failure by the court or a party to act. So failure that modifies the verb that is attached to the court, failure by the court, that failure also has to be attached to the party. So it also could read failure by the court or failure by a party to act.
Your Honor, I am of the opinion that statute would be applicable in this situation related to the time period as to dealing with the mandatory time limits and would apply. Also looking at the two-day time period related to whether or not the two-day time period would be an overall mandatory time period.
Counsel, I just want to interrupt you. I know the time's coming close to a halt. I don't think that I saw in your briefs any talk or analysis of RAM's due process rights by the failure to wait 2 days to hold that dispositional hearing. What are your thoughts about her due process rights?
The state did not address the due process rights on that because that was not one of the three questions that was brought up on the petition for review. The questions related to that were specifically the three questions petitioned by the court. I know the RAM addressed it in her questions. However, they were not one of the questions that were petitioned by the court or by the guardian ad litem, so the state did not address that. I would be willing to supplementally brief that if the court would want that.
Can we get back to
yes.
when you were talking about the absurd results regarding your first point? You never got to make that first point.
Yes. Dealing with the absurd results on the automatic waiver of counsel, specifically dealing the concerns that the state would have allowing the automatic waiver of counsel, the two-day waiting period is going to be substantially longer than 2 days. If we have to wait 2 days every time
Well, it wouldn't have been in this case, based on the record. 3 days were set aside for that final hearing, correct?
In this case, yes. But if every time a parent is defaulted, that we have to wait 2 days every time a parent is defaulted because we're discharging counsel, if we have to wait 2 days, it's going to be substantially longer because of court congestion, because of calendar congestion, because of witness availability. So the fact that we're waiting 2 days is going to be a lot longer than 2 days for children in foster care system, and they're going to be waiting much longer than 2 days because of that. The other absurd result is that we're going to have a situation like we have here, is the fact that we're going to have a situation where a parent is in communication with their attorney, but they're going to be waiving counsel. We have a situation where RAM, was in communication with her attorney, yet we would have an automatic waiver of counsel, which really flies in the face of the State versus Shirley E. The idea is that you would want to err on the side of keeping counsel on. The reason the state is arguing in favor of the explicit waiver of counsel and having the court make a explicit waiver of counsel and a direct finding on the record rather than this implicit waiver of counsel is because we're erring on of keeping counsel on. We don't want to have this automatic waiver of counsel because we want to keep counsel on whenever possible. That's the goal. And we don't want to have counsel being taken off without a direct finding on the record. We don't want to have counsel being taken off without warning to parents. The idea is to keep counsel on whenever possible. And this ruling by the court in State versus RAM is going to lead to removing counsel more quickly for parents, lead to removing counsel without warning to parents, and lead to waiving counsel when parents don't know that they're leaving counsel. We're going to have situations where the court doesn't have the discretion to take counsel off for parents. There are a lot of situations where a parent might be defaulted, but you want counsel on. A situation where a parent might not come to court, but they might want to do a voluntary. Oh, I see my time went off. Can I finish my thought?
Your sentence or two.
A parent might not come to court because they have other situations or mental health issues, but they might want to do a voluntary or have other issues later down, and we want to keep that counsel on to help them in that process. But this law and this interpretation of this law would take that counsel away from them. And the idea is to interpret it to give discretion to the court so that they can keep counsel on whenever possible. Thank you.
Thank you. And I neglected to mention Justice Kroski is obviously appearing by phone.
Yep.
May it please the court, I'm Pamela Mooreshead, and I represent RAM, the response. To listen to the arguments of the state and the GAL, one would think that this was a very interesting case. It isn't. This case is not interesting. It's actually quite boring.
Don't tell the students that.
Please, before they know.
A long trip.
The state and the GAL have described a case presenting thorny issues surrounding the right to counsel in TPR cases, issues that they claim have even serious potential constitutional implications. In their first issue, they ask, does a circuit court striking a parent's contest posture and entering default judgment after a finding of bad faith and egregious behavior by the respondent automatically trigger a waiver of counsel under 48.23? Let me clear this up right at the outset. No, it doesn't. RAM has never argued that it did. RAM has never argued that counsel is waived automatically when there's an egregiousness finding. And in fact, the Court of Appeals did not hold that. In the footnote, footnote number 11 in the Court of Appeals opinion, the court rejects the reasoning of the JB case, the unpublished Court of Appeals case, specifically, and then goes on in the body of the opinion to find that there was a finding of waiver here based on the court's limitations on counsel's ability to act. But nowhere in the Court of Appeals opinion did the court say that a finding of egregiousness against a parent leads to an automatic waiver of the right to counsel. And as I said in my brief, if this court were to read the Court of Appeals opinion, I would agree that that is simply wrong.
But it is a bit confusing because the Court of Appeals opinion suggests that there's some, I don't know, in between where you sort of have counsel, but you don't have full counsel. That's really not a waiver of counsel. And there may be limitations on the evidence that the parent is allowed to present, but there's still counsel participating. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that there's some confusing language in the Court of Appeals opinion.
So there's an opportunity for us to clear that up. My question for you, if the court accepts your argument that textually the statute says what it says, if the court finds a parent's conduct egregious, the court may not hold a dispositional hearing for 2 days. My question for you is, this does appear within the statute that addresses waiver of counsel. So if we simply apply that language, one could argue in isolation, it says what it says, but it does appear within the waiver of counsel statute. So what do we do with that, the structure of the statute and that context? Does it, even though the statute doesn't expressly say this, does it only apply when there has been a waiver of counsel?
I'm glad you brought up the issue of context. The argument that somehow the structure of the statute and the context within this language appears is not really an argument that either of my opponents has made. I think it's a reasonable argument. I would say this. I think it's clear that in determining what how to read plain language in a statute, it's clear in the cases that context is relevant, context is important. I would say that here, context actually favors RAM's position. And the reason for that is because the statutory section that follows the one at issue here, the statutory subsection, which is 48.23 sub C, So immediately following the language that's at issue here, 48.23 sub C says, in a proceeding to vacate or reconsider a default judgment granted in an involuntary termination of parental rights proceeding, a parent who has waived counsel under sub B1 or is presumed to have waived counsel under sub B3 is entitled to counsel at that further proceeding. So I think this subsection makes it clear that sub B1 deals with people who have waived the right to counsel, and sub B3 is all about people who have been presumed to have waived the right to counsel. Otherwise, the statute would have said who has waived counsel under sub B1 or sub B3. So I think that the language immediately following makes it clear that sub B3 does not have anything to do with waiver of counsel. It doesn't have anything to do with people who have been found to have waived the right to counsel. It has to do with how this presumption is set up that can lead to a finding of waiver of counsel.
This statute, you know, it seems that you both have problems because statute, you know, your argument has weak points, right? So the argument favoring your position, it seems to me, is that the statute simply doesn't say if there is a waiver, then you have this waiting period, right? It just says if you have these sort of predicate factual findings, then you have the 2-day waiting period between grounds and disposition. The problem, I think, on the other side is it also doesn't say if you make factual findings, the egregiousness and bad faith factual findings, that can be used to support default or some other discovery sanction or something entirely unrelated to the waiver of counsel, that you need the 2-day waiting period. It doesn't say that. Nothing in the statute links those at all, other than the fact that it's the same, you know, sort of predicate factual findings. So the hard part here is when the legislature adds in this factual finding and creates a whole new subsection for waiver of counsel by conduct, in that's exactly what the statute says. It's you have a right to counsel. You can waive it voluntarily if you're over 18, not if you're under 18, or you have this sort of presumption of waiver by conduct and whatever. So it seems that there's a problem on both sides. What's your best argument for the idea that these factual findings relate to something about an entirely different matter, which is discovery sanctions, right? So the structural, contextual, plain meaning argument against your position is simply, when the statute references the factual findings, it can only be referencing factual findings related to waiver of counsel by conduct or the presumption of waiver. And this is another question about whether waiver occurs or not, whether you need a delay. Put that aside for a minute. You know, why would the statute, should it be read to link to something that has nothing to do with waiver of counsel and has no textual link to waiver of counsel other than it's the same type of factual finding the courts require?
So I know that one of the arguments here is that there are some kind of different kinds of egregiousness findings with different effects. So there's an egregiousness finding that can lead to a statutory default under 80503. There's the egregiousness finding in Shirley E. There's the egregiousness finding in the statute, but those are somehow different. I don't think there's any reason to believe that the egregiousness language in this statute is just coincidentally the same as the standard that was well established at the time as the standard for a finding of default judgment. So the Shirley E. case, the Evelyn C.R. case, Jessica S., there were a number of cases that set forth the finding of egregiousness and without justifiable excuse as the basis for a default judgment. And as the guardian ad litem said, that was a term of art, egregiousness and without justifiable excuse, at the time this statute was enacted after Evelyn C.R. and pretty clearly, I think, in reaction to Evelyn C.R. So I don't think there's any reason to believe that egregiousness language being the same as the default standard is just a coincidence.
To be clear, just follow up, I totally agree with you. I think it's absolutely not a coincidence. They obviously used it intentionally. But that doesn't answer the question. The question is whether when the legislature uses the same finding that can also be used for default and creates a brand new waiver by conduct exception and puts it in a statutory section dealing with the right to counsel and the waiver of counsel, So that kind of factual finding might be known. It was certainly known. But if it can support two different sort of operations, waiver and default, but the text doesn't link the two, one structural textual argument is that by not linking the two explicitly in the statute, tucking this two-day waiting period into the very end of a waiver by conduct exception, that it only meant that that finding, when used for purposes of finding waiver by conduct, is the two-day waiting period triggered. And if that finding is only used for default and not for waiver by conduct, then we're not in this statutory language world, and nothing in the statute links the two. Either one of those, there's good arguments on both sides, I think, because the statute's not very clear. It doesn't say two things. It doesn't say, on the one hand, that it's invoking the standard for default, and it doesn't say, on the other hand, you need to find waiver. And I think that's the part that I do find this an interesting case, and at least that I'm wrestling with. So,
I would refer again to the plain language. And I would also say that statutory subsection, again, sub 2B3, isn't about a finding of waiver. It is about what can happen that creates a presumption.
Right.
And what can happen that creates a presumption is this finding of egregiousness. And that finding of egregiousness happened in this case. And it created a presumption of the waiver of counsel.
Factually, did the trial court make a distinction about why it was finding it, right? So the question here is what's the purpose for that finding? Is it for purposes of establishing waiver by conduct and starting with a presumption? Or is it for purposes of default? And does that matter for the waiting period? So I think your opponents on the other side said the finding was only relating to default, and therefore we're not in 48.23 world. And what would be your response to that?
I think because the egregiousness language was the language that applied to default, and now it has been put in this statute, I think that it's clear that what the statute does is say that when a court makes an egregiousness finding and defaults somebody, that this presumption is created by that egregiousness finding. That is, I don't think courts are in the business of saying, I'm finding egregiousness for purpose of default, I'm finding egregiousness for purpose of waiver. I don't think there's any reason to believe in the text of the statute that those are separate findings. This legislature knew how default worked and knew what the triggering language was for a default when it enacted the statute. And so I think it makes actually perfect sense that in this situation where this egregiousness finding was made, a presumption of waiver of counsel arises, that then this very modest protection has been afforded to parents who, you know, of necessity, once all this has happened, they're not there. They have no way of knowing if the court is going to proceed directly to disposition. And the statute creates a very modest protection for people in that situation against whom that egregiousness finding has been made.
So you don't think this statute deals with waiver of counsel? Do you think counsel was waived here?
I don't.
Okay. So you don't think that the two-day requirement has anything to do with waiver of counsel?
I think the two-day waiting requirement is triggered when the egregiousness finding is made and the presumption of waiver arises, regardless of whether the court ever finds a waiver of counsel.
But the entirety of the statute deals with the right to counsel and what you do when you don't show up and you're waiving your right to counsel. Then things proceed differently if there's no lawyer involved. But here there was a lawyer involved. This person, with all due respect, this is probably or should be the most important thing going on in that person's life. Their children are being taken away. And they can't find their way to court. And repeatedly the judge tries to find a way to get this person to court and know what has to happen for this person to meaningfully participate. And they choose and do something else. instead of coming to court so the proceedings continue with that person's lawyer. Of course, the case isn't going to be handled the same way because that person chose not to appear and advocate for themselves. Having said that, this section completely deals with the right of the parent to a lawyer, and when a parent doesn't appear, if they still have that right to a lawyer, and they had their right to a lawyer. Counsel was never waived by conduct in this case. So I just don't even understand how the 2 days applies at all.
I mean,
I think the problem is, just to kind of springboard off of what the Chief just said, I understand what you're saying when you say when the court makes the egregiousness finding, the egregiousness and without clear and justifiable excuse finding, that we are in this presumption of waiver statute. I think that's how you're getting into the 4823 2B world, right? You're saying 2B3 world. You're saying, yeah, look, we are talking about waiver of counsel. We're talking about the presumption of waiver of counsel. But I think the confusing part is here, it gets us to the statute, but then no one ever talks about, in this case, the presumption of waiver of counsel or waiver of counsel at all. The judge just went on as if it made a default finding, but we still end up in the statute. So I think it's confusing for us how we get here when we're not talking about waiver of counsel or, as you keep saying, the presumption of waiver of counsel.
So I think Justice Kroski, you're correctly characterizing my argument in that once this egregiousness finding was made, by operation of this statute, there was a presumption of the waiver of counsel. There's no reason to believe that RAM would have had a very difficult time arguing that the court found my conduct to be egregious and without justifiable excuse, but 48.23 doesn't apply to me. The statute very clearly created a presumption of waiver.
Because of the word egregious? Because the judge used the magic word egregious. Had the judge not said that word, would you be making the same argument?
No, I would not. But I would say...
But we require certain findings just for plain old default, regardless of the statute dealing with when you give up your right to a lawyer. So judges are precluded from making egregiousness findings in the context of defaulting a parent in a you are giving up your right to your children case. I mean, judges make egregiousness findings. They have to. But it doesn't always relate to waiver of counsel. How does a judge do that and not invoke the two-day time period now?
So a couple of things. First, when the court refers to magic words that the court used, I would say we're not talking about magic words. We're talking about legal terms with a very well-established and accepted meaning.
If the judge wanted to use the word egregious, would we be in the statute?
Well, if the judge had not used the word egregious, then the judge couldn't have defaulted RAM.
Right, that's my point. So how do you default
We wouldn't
someone?
Be here at all.
How do you default someone without being in the statute?
I think the court needed, if the court wanted to default RAM, the court needed to make the egregiousness finding. And then I think that this statute kicked in and created a presumption of waiver.
In every default situation, the statute kicks in, is what you're saying. It is not limited to what it says, which is waiver of counsel and right to counsel. You're saying the statute is overriding in every TPR and every default finding, disposition can't occur for 2 days, whether you have a lawyer or not.
I'm saying that once the default judgment is entered based on the egregiousness finding, this statute creates a presumption of the waiver of right to counsel, something REM could not have gotten out from under.
But you
and
think, didn't, I just want to make sure, was counsel waived here or not?
I do not believe that RAM waived her right to counsel. I mean, one of the difficult things about this case is the confusion of the words waiver and forfeiture. The statute and all the case law speaks in terms of the word waiver.
There's a different creature than forfeiture.
Yes. you know, we have never argued that RAM waived her right to counsel. The question of waiver here and what the court did to limit counsel's participation, RAM made what is commonly understood as a fallback argument. And that was that if the court was persuaded by the reasoning in the unpublished decision in JB that somehow some kind of waiver was required in order to trigger the operation of the statute, a position I think is flatly wrong. But if the court was persuaded by that, this case is distinguishable from JB because here the circuit court didn't expressly find waiver, but did some very peculiar things that limited the ability of counsel to act that indicated at least some kind of implicit finding of waiver.
Can I ask you a question? If suppose a trial court had said, listen, I think, you know, your client has been egregious, you know, has acted egregiously and in bad faith, but I'm not going to default them. Oh, and by the way, you have counsel and you can represent them, even though your client's not here. Then what? Is this two-day waiting period implicated? So there's an acknowledgement that the factual standard of egregiousness and bad faith has been satisfied, but no finding of default. So that sanction, even though it could have been applied, the court decides not to do it. Do you think that invokes the statute?
Potentially, but I think there's something about the hypothetical that I'm not sure works, in that if the court found her conduct to be egregious and without justifiable excuse, but declined to default her, then I'm not sure the court could proceed outside her presence then and just continue with the hearing. I think the default was necessary to allow the court to plow ahead outside her presence.
Can I just one other follow-up?
Yeah, really it was a follow-up to what you were saying.
Can you make it be that place the waiver of attorney issue?
My question is just, so in some ways your argument is if the trial court finds egregious and bad faith behavior and they default them, the two-day thing is, you know, the 2 days is implicated.
Automatic.
Regardless of whether it has anything to do with the right to counsel.
Regardless of what?
Whether it has anything to do with the right to counsel.
Without the requirement that there be a waiver of counsel.
I
believe that's clear in the statute.
I'm not understanding whether this, under your argument, whether this two-day time frame is applicable to every TPR proceeding. I think it has to be. If it applies in this situation where there is no waiver of counsel, it has to apply in every other situation where someone might be defaulted. I don't understand how this is cabined to anything other than I don't understand how under your argument this is cabined to anything. I think you're saying in every TPR default situation, this two-day waiting period applies.
I believe that is true. Yes, because the default requires a finding of egregiousness. Once the egregiousness of finding is made, this statute creates a presumption, and one thing that follows from this presumption being created is that there has to be a two-day wait.
And that despite this being a right to counsel, counsel statute, it applies to everything, even if you still have a lawyer.
It applies to defaults in which an egregiousness finding has been made.
You've made the argument that the only purpose for the two-day waiting period is to give the parent an opportunity to participate in the disposition hearing. Where in the text of the statutory scheme do you see that purpose reflected?
I think the purpose is obvious. To me it is. You're correct. There is nothing in the statute that says we're doing this to give this parent an opportunity to appear. I can't think of any other possible reason for it. There is one, but I can't think of one.
One possible reason, if the argument is correct that this only applies when counsel has been waived, then it's to give the parent an opportunity to show up, present testimony to the court without counsel, presumably, but to have an opportunity to appear so that it's not a completely one-sided hearing with the state and the guardian ad litem advocating for termination of parental rights.
I think it does serve that purpose. I think that is a purpose that it serves, but that doesn't mean it doesn't also serve the purpose of allowing a parent against whom a default judgment has been made in her absence an opportunity to at least appear at the, you know, at least a fighting chance of appearing at the DISPO hearing when she's not present and has no way of knowing that the court's going to immediately proceed to the disposition.
Isn't this a good example of that kind of case where perhaps she really was clearing a warrant and or some other circumstance? If someone was, let's say someone was ill, but they had not come to court and so it had been an egregiousness finding because they just kept not coming to court, but then they were able to return the next day with a doctor's note saying, I get that I didn't come those other times, but this last time I had an excuse, and so will you please reconsider the default judgment, right? Doesn't it serve that purpose too?
Yes, for sure. So I did not sort of join issue about the reasons for the default finding and the facts here and what happened. I don't think they're relevant to any of the issues that are presented here, strictly speaking.
You are not contesting the default.
We are not. We never have. But you know, the facts here are far from crystal clear. And certainly in a situation like this, the statute would allow the person to come to court and explain their absence. It prevents this case from concluding, going all the way through the disposition and concluding and resulting in a termination that this person doesn't even know is happening because she's not there and she's been defaulted and they're proceeding in her absence. It's actually a very modest protection.
You act as if this is an innocent bystander who couldn't possibly know that they should show up to court that day for a hearing on whether or not they get to be the parent. I mean, this is not that scenario. The court made findings, and the findings weren't, oh, gosh, maybe they didn't get notice, maybe they didn't know, maybe they had no idea, maybe they wouldn't possibly know. If they want to know what's going on, they show up to court. This was not a hidden proceeding. This was something where the person was required, and the court found that this person acted over and over and over in such a way that it was egregious. So the facts here are relevant to the extent that this isn't something where they couldn't possibly know what was going to happen and they needed to be protected from that. They could show up and know what's happening.
So a couple of things. I think it is worth pointing out that RAM ended 3 days of testimony in this case before she missed court. This was not a parent who simply blew off her obligations to appear in court. And you are absolutely correct, Chief Justice, that she had noticed that she needed to be on this day, and she failed to appear. What I'm saying, though, is that while she was not there and this finding was made and she was found in default, she had no reason to know or to believe that this case was going to go through the disposition in her absence.
And that's the tail wagging
the dog. Didn't the Court of Appeals in this case, the Court of Appeals in footnote 10, they said our examination of the record does not support that RAM repeatedly missed hearings or failed to comply with court orders. They go on to cite the statute about the egregious and without clear and justifiable excuse language, and then they say this logically supports that missing a single hearing or non-consecutive hearings would not trigger the presumption of egregious conduct. RAM didn't challenge the circuit court's findings, but it certainly seems that the Court of Appeals agrees with the argument you're making right now.
Yes, you know, I think that what that footnote demonstrates is that the facts here are not crystal clear and they're not one-sided. But again, we didn't challenge that finding. So I have not point by point argued about the egregiousness finding.
So you have very little time left, but what do you want us to, what are you asking us to say? Because we have a Court of Appeals decision in front of us. What do you want us to say?
So I think it's unfortunate that the Court of Appeals got bogged down in the secondary argument about the implicit finding of waiver. I don't think the Court of Appeals needed to do that. And it resulted in some confusing language that this Court has the opportunity to clear up. I think all the Court of Appeals needed to do was apply the plain language of the statute. And the plain language of the statute says, once this egregiousness finding was made, the default predicate finding, a presumption of counsel, a waiver of counsel happened, and then this protection kicked in, regardless of whether there was ever a waiver of the right to counsel. I think the application of that plain language is really all the work that the Court needs to do, and it would result in a much clearer opinion.
If the presumption is triggered, and it may very well be in this case because of the failure to appear and the egregiousness finding, what happens next? So there's a presumption, but a presumption is just that. It's rebuttable. Who has the burden of proof? Your light is off.
Go ahead and answer.
May I answer? Mm-hmm. So what would happen next is the Court may find that there's a waiver of counsel and may, I believe sub 4 of the statute, may discharge counsel. Those are things that may occur once that presumption kicks in. They didn't occur in this case, except to the extent that the Court, I think, implicitly found some kind of waiver or forfeiture, because there's really no other explanation for the Court refusing to allow counsel to call witnesses or object.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the Court of Appeals opinion and the SPD argument here really seems to be that statewide, if a person is found to have egregiously violated a scheduling order for a discovery violation, they are found to have acted egregiously, they have now lost their right to counsel. That's absurd.
Lost the right to counsel? There's a presumption. It doesn't mean they lost the right to counsel. I don't even hear that the SPD is arguing that.
Your Honor, the SPD is arguing that any time the word egregiousness is said in court, that this statute applies.
And that's a presumption, not a waiver. So they haven't lost anything, right?
Your Honor, the statute is that it's a waiver of the right to counsel. And so if a parent has waived their right to counsel, they don't have a right to counsel anymore.
Well, let's break that down, because the statute says the parent is presumed to have waived her right to counsel if the court has ordered the parent to appear, which is uncontested, and the parent fails to appear, which is also uncontested, and the court finds that the parent's conduct in failing to appear was egregious and without justifiable excuse. That also is uncontested. So the presumption did come into play here, right?
Your Honor, if we read presumed to be a legal term of art, then yes, it did. But if we follow Kalal and statutory interpretation and read presume to have its common ordinary meaning of constituting reasonable evidence for assuming, that allows the court to maintain discretion and requires the court to say, this is egregious and I'm waiving your right to counsel, rather than saying this is egregious and I'm defaulting you under 80503.
Well, it seems like what happened is the presumption is automatic under the statute if all of those factors are in play, which they are in this case, but then the trial court didn't address it, right? Because I think there seems to be some agreement here that there wasn't an express waiver, but there was some kind of, well, you gave up some of your rights and your counsel has one arm tied behind your back, so to speak.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you restate your question?
Sure. The presumption did kick in, but the trial court did not do anything with that presumption in, as far as addressing it or coming to any findings, making any findings with respect to it. What the trial court did was put limits on the attorney's ability to participate, present evidence, make objections.
Correct, which is, I think, is further evidence, this implicit waiver situation. That was an implicit waiver of the right to counsel. It was an explicit sanction under 804.12 because the court had defaulted her. And I apologize. I see I'm out of time.
Goes fast. Thank you. All right. Interesting oral argument this morning. Nice to have all your students here as well. The court will adjourn, and we will reconvene for the second oral argument when...